Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time. One episode at a time.
Hey, I got a question for you. Are you a proponent of brief therapy? And when I say brief, one session, many individuals, couples, and families avoid getting the help they need due to barriers such as time constraints, being sure about committing to therapy, the cost, or the stigma associated with getting mental health help. Single session therapy allows the client to see what therapy is like, even to try different therapists. It can be particularly useful for clients who might have certain reservations about traditional or extended forms of psychotherapy, or those who just want to bounce some ideas off a non-biased third party without any long-term commitment, or have a space to vent about a difficult life situation with a non-judgmental professional. Think about it like an appointment required at a walk-in clinic. In a nutshell, it's coming in for a single session of therapy with no commitment to return. Some people find that one session of therapy is all they're looking for. Single session therapy is not about focusing on the roots of things or long, extensive histories, but centers on what would be the most useful for you today and in this session. SST focuses on how to make the most of the client's innate ability to help themselves, their inner strengths and resources, providing insights into bolstering the client's existing skills, restoring autonomy and confidence, and helping to craft solutions and next steps that can be implemented quickly. Today, on this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Michael Hoyt, expert and one of the pioneers in single session therapy. And we're going to talk about what that work looks like. He's going to share his ideas and methods on how to make a single session of therapy efficient and effective with individuals, couples, and families. Perfect fit for our systemic therapists out there. He shares some great stories and clinical examples as well. And Michael has had a chance to work with the who's who in the history of MFT, including pioneers like Carl Whitaker and Jay Haley, as we'll mention today. Michael Hoyt is a psychologist in independent practice in Mill Valley, California. He is the author and editor of numerous books, including Brief Psychotherapies, Principles and Practices, Therapist Stories of Inspiration, Passion and Renewal and Capturing the Moment, Single Session Therapy and Walk-In Services. He is a Woodrow Wilson Fellow and has been honored as a continuing education distinguished speaker by both the APA, that's the American Psychological Association, and the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. His new book, Single Session Therapy, A Clinical Introduction to Principles and Practices explores the best way to use SST mindset to better achieve goals. I think this episode is essential for young therapists and even our most seasoned practitioners out there. I learned a lot, and I hope you will too. We'll be back after our talk with Michael. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. I am so happy to be joined by Dr. Michael Hoyt, and we are talking about today something that we have never in our seven seasons done a show on, and that is single session therapy, which we'll abbreviate SST. So I had to find one of the foremost experts who's made a career out of doing that, and that is Michael. So Michael, the first question we always ask, we like to know the expert's origin story. How'd you get interested in psychotherapy in general, and then specifically a brief therapy, the briefest of all brief therapies, single session therapy. So tell us about your background, my friend.
Good morning, Eli. It's really a delight to be here, and good morning to the people who are listening. I got interested in therapy like a duck going to water. It was just natural. I grew up in a family of storytellers. People like to tell stories and jokes. And I found it was just fascinating to listen to people talk and how they looked at things. Many years ago, I trained with Carl Whitaker, the family therapist. And Carl once said to me, being a therapist is rich living. And I agree completely. It's wonderful, rich living. I was never interested in molecules or how to fix cars or how to build furniture, even how to make money or do business. I was always interested in stories and how people looked at things, poetry, anthropology, that kind of thing. So I just took to it. I think it was the eighth grade, I had a counselor at school who recognized my interest. And he said, here's a book I think you might like, Michael. And he gave me a book called The Interpretation of Dreams by Sigmund Freud. And I read it cover to cover, and I was off and running. In my family, growing up, my parents had a diversity of friends, different ethnicities, and all of that. But my folks used to like to tell the story later after I got a PhD that they knew I was going to be a psychologist, because when they would have friends over, after the friends left, I would ask things like, when Mrs. Silver starts talking about their daughter, why does Mr. Silver always go outside and say he has to have a cigarette right then? I would notice behaviors and patterns much more than others, maybe I shouldn't say more than other people, but how I was oriented to the world. The way I got particularly interested in brief therapy, a couple of things. One is I was very interested in the idea of efficient, helping people as quick as possible therapy. And I was interested in all the different ways people change their minds and teaching tales and Sufi tales and Zen stories and all of that. And I was also very interested in ways it could elevate people's capacities. It appreciated their strengths and abilities more than just their weaknesses or problems. So brief therapy became particularly the right thing. I'm 75 years old now. I was born at the end of 1948. I got my PhD in 1976. And I took a job as Kaiser Permanente, a large HMO in California. And they were very interested in efficiency. At the same time, I was in Northern California at a time when we had the Esalen Institute talking about human potential. We had Mental Research Institute, MRI, about an hour away. So I met with Vaclavic, Weakland, all of those folks. I met Jay Haley, Gregory Bateson. So it was in the air. Even more specifically, how single session therapy came about. I was already interested in brief therapy, but I have a colleague. His name is Moshe Talmon. He's Israeli. He lives back in Tel Aviv now. And Moshe was working at the clinic I was working at in Northern California. And one day, Moshe was sitting in the chief of the department's office, and he was looking at computer printouts, as we had them then. And he noticed that all the providers, the most frequent length of treatment was one session. Whether you're on the adult team, the child team, the chemical dependency team, whether you were psychodynamic or cognitive behavioral or solution focused or whatever, found that very interesting. And he thought, ooh, we must be doing something wrong. People quit, they drop out, they don't come back. But then Moshe did something very brave, I think. He decided to call 200 of the patients, introduced himself, and said, I see you've only been seen once here in the clinic. what happened? And he discovered that most of the people said, I got what I needed. I came in, I had a problem, I got to talk to somebody, I got some ideas, I got some encouragement, and he was happy. And they were happy. So rather than they were dropouts, they were really graduates. They had gotten what they wanted. Shea then approached another colleague, Bob Rosenbaum, and then myself, and said, let's do a research project. So we approached our employer, got a small grant, and we then decided to see 60 patients in a row, children, adults, whoever came in. It was their consent that we recorded sessions. And we did not have one single therapeutic approach, but rather whatever skills we had, Moshe had trained, particularly with Sal Mnuchin. I had worked with Bob Goulding and Carl Whitaker. Bob Rosenbaum was very interested in Ericksonian therapy and hypnosis at the time. And we did whatever we could. And we say to people at the beginning, the purpose of our meeting today is briefly to find out what problems you're having, what brings you here, and then work together to figure out a solution. Maybe we can get it done in one session. If not, we can make more sessions, but why don't we see where we're at? That was the beginning of this. We found that most people, 58%, elected to complete their therapy in one session. 42% went on for more. But then when we did follow-ups, 3 and 13 month follow-ups, we found that there was no difference between the completer, the one session folks, and the longer folks. And 58% had said that one session had been very helpful. They had elected one session, and more than 80%, 88% said the one session had either been helpful or very helpful if they got what they wanted. And many of the people reported secondary benefits. Not only am I less anxious, but I'm getting along better with my spouse, or not only am I sleeping better, but things are going better at work. So this was the first of these studies. Since then, there have been dozens and dozens of studies all around the world about single session therapy, from little acorns, big oaks have grown. There have been 4 international conferences. But the basic of single session therapy is that the therapist and the client expect that the therapy from the beginning to potentially comprise a single visit.
From the onset, it is being framed as briefed from the beginning. So I know coming in, if I am the client, that this is probably only going to be one session, which changes the mindset and the motivation for both the therapist and the client.
Thank you for clarifying that. So now there are many clinics that are single session therapy clinics. There are a number of university counseling centers where you can click on a website, do I want to be seen for a single session therapy or an ongoing therapy? So sometimes the people have pre-selected themselves to be single session. Other times people come in and say, I don't know what I want. And we say, maybe we can get it done in one visit. Why don't we see how that goes? And at the end, if you think you need more, we can certainly schedule more, but let's see if we can possibly get it done in one. So from the beginning, there's at least the potential that it'll be one visit. In a nutshell, working in a collaborative and culturally appropriate manner, one is planning for one visit. Sometimes we call it one at a time, O-A-A-T. One at a time. It's important not to say to people, you're only going to get one session or you get one shot. Insistence produces resistance. Imposition produces opposition. So if you say to somebody, you only get one, they say, well, how about if I need more? Or doesn't my coverage include more? That sort of it. So it's the invitation. Let's see if we can get it done in one, or the person's already come in one session. So planning for one visit. Second is identifying the client's goal for the session. What do you want to get from today so that when you're leaving, you'll feel it was worthwhile coming in? What would tell you that you're going in the right direction? Yeah, the client's goal, very important. The third is looking for client's strengths and abilities that can be used. And this also, of course, supports hope because they begin to think about past successes they've had, resources they have that they could apply. We're trying to find the strengths and abilities. From an Ericksonian perspective, we might say utilization. We're trying to find what abilities they have, both internal abilities as well as other resources. Who could help you? Then the fourth point is to encourage the application of whatever their strengths are in the problematic situation. You've told me you're very good at X, Y, and Z. How could you use that in this particular problem? Or it sounds like you've dealt with something similar before. Or when the problem isn't a problem, what are you doing differently then? Maybe doing more of that would be helpful. So we look for exceptions to the problem, as we'd say in solution-focused therapy. So those are the four characteristics. And then the fifth is leaving the door open for possible return or possible follow-up. It's very important to remember that one at a time does not mean only one time. One at a time does not necessarily mean only one time. But this was the idea of single session therapy. It's not one session therapy that could have gone on and it just ended in one. It was intentionally one session from the get-go. Two colleagues of mine, Jeff Young and Pam Ryecroft from Australia at the Bouverie Center in Melbourne, edited a book called Single Session Thinking and Practice in Global Cultural and Family Context. And we've expanded the idea of single session therapy. We're saying now the essence of single session thinking is to approach the first session as if it will be the only session while creating opportunities for further work that is requested by the client. So what emerges is a collaborative, direct, and transparent approach providing services that puts the client in a very active role in determining the focus and length of the work. What I want to underscore here is it was not therapists who invented single session therapy. It was clients who would come in for one visit. If I told you some of the very brief history of single session therapy, the first single session therapist was Sigmund Freud. Some of his early cases were one visit. He had one with Gustav Mahler, where they went for a long walk in Leiden in the Netherlands. Another with Katharina, when Freud was on vacation with his family in the Alps. And Katharina's parents, she was a young adolescent girl, had some emotional difficulties. And her parents were the innkeepers where Freud was staying. So again, it's sometimes by necessity that the therapist may be only available for one, but it's oftentimes that the client only wants to come in one. In a big study done in Australia with more than 100,000 people, 42% elected to have a single session, even though more sessions were available, just as that more sessions were available in our original study that we did at Kaiser some years ago. Single session therapy is essentially a delivery or a format. It's one session. It's usually 50 minutes or it could be 90 minutes with the family, however you do it. It's not a particular theoretical approach. It's not solution-focused therapy or psychodynamic therapy or cognitive therapy or strategic systemic therapy. All of those can be used, whatever seems to work for the client and for the clinician, but it's basically a structure. You're going to meet one time. It's going to be a complete unto itself session. So you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Build some alliance, find out what's brought them there, look for exceptions and strengths. How can they apply those?
It strikes me that your pedigree in the time where you came of age as a psychotherapist in the 70s, which we consider the golden age of systemic therapy and family therapy, and you really worked with some amazing people. Carl Whitaker, who was quite a character. All these people, the MRI people, Jay Haley, but the commonality between those guys and those pioneers is they were doing, even though you learned to do this through your clients, because as your colleague Moshe Talman interviewed and got the feedback, when your pioneers were doing the work, they were usually doing single sessions, consultations. They were traveling the country and the lead therapist would bring the case to the expert and they would have the consultation and leave and never appear. So it strikes me as interesting. The people you worked with, even though they weren't calling that, they were doing a lot of single sessions by themselves. And Carl Whitaker, we talk about the battle for structure, the battle for initiative. Every session is the first and every session is the last. And then the client must initiate if there is a follow-up. So I think another takeaway is the setting, and some settings lend more to this, like you said, university counseling centers, and it is a way to try out therapy. So I wonder if you could talk about some of the benefits of this approach as well.
So there's no one single goal in a single session therapy. Some people come in, and I can tell a couple of stories of big moments and something really dramatic, but other times people will come in simply because I want to check something out, or I need to bounce my ideas, or I want to get some support, or I want to see if this sounds normal, or what are three things I could do to communicate better with my partner, or how do I deal with my teenager, whatever the particular problems are. So there's no one goal. It's true that single session therapies occur in clinical demonstration interviews. You're saying about people traveling around the country, they're therapist is only going to be there once. They're the most frequent length of therapy in all settings, private and public. People go to see a therapist one time, and many of them don't come back for whatever reason. So single session therapy takes place in outpatient settings, inpatient settings. Irv Yalom has written about in inpatient hospital group therapy, each group session is really a single session therapy because you're not going to have the same people in the group time after time. So it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. The first talk that we gave was at a Bruce Therapy conference, first major talk at a national conference, at Bruce Therapy conference the Ericksonian Foundation put on. And somebody wrote a paper about the effect of demonstration interviews, just like what you were talking about. Whitaker used to say that he thought the best sessions, the best therapies lasted one session. The family came together, something powerful happened, some changes occurred in their system, and it was only one session. Haley said the same thing. He felt that we should try to have one session and get something done. Single session therapy is the most common length of treatment in all of Milton Erickson's cases. Long-term therapy, I love different approaches, but there's been something where people sometimes have a resistance and they say real therapy is long and deep and brief, and even single session is palliative or band-aid or it's covering over. I don't think so. We've seen many people come in for one, two sessions, get what they really needed, take the ball and run on their own. The research evidence is pretty clear. Certainly, frequency, one session is the most common length of therapy. In terms of outcomes, there's a lot of evidence that many people get a lot of benefit in terms of anxiety, depression, even substance abuse in one visit. A lot of people with compulsive gambling problems talk to somebody once and they're able to make significant changes. A lot of couples therapy happens in one visit. It's also a single session structure. It's a very handy model for doing research because it's small enough you can look and see what's going on in that session instead of it went on for 12 months or 6 months and it's so much. It's one session. I could give lots of quotations from Bill O'Hanlon and Michelle Wiener Davis and all sorts of other folks saying that these single sessions happen enough that they're not flukes. In fact, they're the most common length of therapy. So once we recognize that, the question then became for researchers, who are the people most benefiting and what happens in those sessions to help them? And could therapists do more of that with other patients? One of the things that I've been very interested in is rather than saying to people, we're going to teach you how to do single session therapy or do it our way, then much more, think about the times when you've seen somebody once or twice, or even you've been a client and in one or two visits, something really good happened. What happened then? How could you do more of that using your particular approach, whether it's strategic or it's solution focused or narrative or whatever? So it's trying to use the client's strengths as much as possible and also using what the clinician is really good at. We want to emphasize that single session therapy is not being sold as a panacea. Oh, this will replace everything else. No, not at all. Single session therapy is not even brief therapy. It's one session therapy, single session therapy. If more sessions are needed, we don't think of it as a single session therapy failure. We just think of, well, they needed two, they needed five, they needed 25, whatever. It's not a replacement for long-term therapy or short-term therapy, other kinds of therapy. But rather, it's just that many people do want to come in for one visit. So let's try to make the most of it for those folks. A lot of people who come in for a single session wind up later saying, that was helpful. I think I'll go back and talk to that therapist again. And they may send their friends. It is true that it's much more attractive in clinics and training centers, where if you're in a private practice model and your salary or your income depends on getting people to keep coming back and keep coming back, then you can say, why would I want to see somebody only once rather than keep seeing them? Partly because we have a fiduciary responsibility to help the clients as much as we can, as soon as we can. But also, it may be that there are other issues that they want to address. I think a lot of times people want to test the water or see how things are. They may get enough help and decide that's all I really want or I really need. Other times people may find it's useful and they want to go back and have more therapy. So again, one at a time does not necessarily mean only one time, but there's a thinking structure that I found useful. And there's different ways of approaching it. But I think of therapy, whether it's one session or many sessions, as being pre-therapy, early, middle, late, and follow through. Certain things happen even before therapy. They begin to think about therapy, getting into the role early, building an alliance, finding out what may have changed since they decided to come in the middle, doing whatever we do, therapy we do, late, issues of termination, homework, relapse prevention, how they're going to continue after our meeting, and then follow through. The therapy may be brief, but the benefit can be long-term. We say if you give somebody a fish, they eat a meal, but if you teach them how to fish, they can feed themselves. So we try to have people learn things and have more hope and be more empowered, recognize that they have the capacity to solve problems so that they can take some of what they learned in the session or sessions and carry it on. It all comes together when the whole therapy is one session. Then the pre-therapy, sometimes people will get sent a questionnaire or call, or if they just walk into a clinic. I have a couple of colleagues who have been very busy working on walk-in or open access approaches. Arnie Slive and Monty Bobel are their names. They have a book coming out with Rutledge next year. But people come in, they can or get sent a questionnaire to give them some idea. What do you hope to accomplish today? What are some of the skills you have that you might be able to apply? What would tell you it was worth coming in today? Then developing a goal early on. Somebody says, the goal is I want to live a long life and be happy and have my children always love me. That's a big goal. What's your goal for today? What would be useful for today's meeting? So that you make it small enough that it's achievable rather than the big meta goal, the distal goal instead of proximal goal, as we sometimes call it. In the middle, doing whatever we do, sometimes some groups use reflecting teams, some groups do a consultation like the Milan. Go out of the room, you come back. Sometimes if you're just a solo practitioner, you don't have a reflecting team, anything like that. But you do whatever you do, whether it's cognitive restructuring or insight or whatever. Let me just take a little aside just for a moment. One of the very interesting early studies was done at the Tavistock Clinic in London in the mid-1970s. A man named David Mallan, M-A-A-N, and his group, they were very psychodynamically oriented. And they were bringing people in, doing an intake, putting them on a waiting list, and a couple of months later, ringing them up and saying, we're ready to have you start therapy now. And they found that half the people said, I don't really need to have therapy now. Coming in and just talking about what we talked about was all I really needed. It was very helpful. So they looked at the notes that they had taken, and of that group, half of them, a quarter of the whole, had identified a key pattern and recognized their responsibility. Yeah, I push people away when I'm fearful they're going to reject me. Oh, I make jokes when I'm angry. Oh, I pick the wrong partners because whatever it was, and I could do something about that. So once people had some insight and responsibility, a quarter of the people in that psychodynamic setting found that's all the therapy they really needed. They got unstuck, back on track, and they could do the therapy, do the work themselves rather than having to come in week after week. That's not to say that ongoing therapy cannot be very helpful. You work through, you get more support. But the fact, again, I keep repeating it, is that many people want to just come in for one session. But let me say something, if I could, about the mindset of what the single session mindset is. The single session mindset, different people have written about this. Wendy Dryden has written a really excellent book called How to Think and Intervene Like a Single Session Therapist. It's another Rutledge book. My colleague Flavio Canestra and Rome has written a lot about the mindset. There's different ways of thinking about it, but I think there's four essential things that the single session therapy mindset involves. One is the idea that, one, change is possible now. In fact, change is only possible now. There's no time but the present. So one is change now. Two, the idea of one at a time. We're going to have a complete unto itself session, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Rather than we're just going to say, we'll continue next week. We're going to get something done today. The third is very much focusing on the client's goals. What would be helpful for you? What decided you to come in now? What do you want to take away from today's meeting? So it's a single session. What's the goal for that one session? And then the fourth is what my colleague Moshe Talmud calls constructive minimalism, meaning not spending a lot of time on diagnosis, but rather spending more time on therapy. So when things are better, what will they look like? What would be the first steps you could be taking in that direction? That kind of an idea. This is different than the traditional psychotherapy, which I know a fair amount about and was trained in, of course. The traditional format of therapy is we're going to keep meeting until we're done. And it may be 10 visits, it may be 20, we'll just see how it goes. And people sometimes, we have to go very slow and gradually to build alliance. We don't want to stimulate resistance. We don't want to scare the person away, et cetera, et cetera. So the traditional idea is as much as the person can absorb, as much as we can do with them, instead of just what they want and they need. Let's honor their wishes. That's the difference.
You have a lot there, so I'm going to break that down. Let's contextualize for our listeners. So this is a model where an ideal client is someone that is relatively motivated and articulate in the sense that they know what they want to work on. I can identify the goal very early on, and they are ready to go. So they are in either the preparation stage or even the action stage of change. This would not be a good approach for someone that doesn't think they really have something to work on, a pre-contemplator, as we say, or someone, as our solution-focused people, DeShazer, would have called a visitor. This is someone that is ready to go. And it's also a therapist that the pre-screen or giving a client an idea before they come in for the one session of what it will be like, that we're going to identify a goal. We're going to tap into your strengths. We're going to take those strengths, make an action item out of something we talked about in that hour. So say a little more on best practices as far as prepping that client for the one session. I will also say that sometimes this is called walk-in therapy, which is, has the connotation that there is no preparation, but it would seem like to maximize that 50 minutes, a little preparation would be pretty important.
I knew Stephen Insu pretty well, and I know some of the other people, solution-focused world, the folks in London, Harvey Ratner and Chris Iverson, that group. There's customer, complainant, and visitor, to use that model. But people come in, they're a customer for something, and our job is to figure out what they're a customer for. What are they looking for? What would be helpful? There's some reason they're motivated, they took the time to come in, and what is it that they want? Maybe it's just to get my parole officer off of my case, or to get my partner to stop complaining about me, or not to leave. But what would they feel would be most useful? There's a really interesting book that came out recently called No Bullshit Therapy by a colleague of mine, Jeff Young. It's another Rutledge book, How to Engage People Who Don't Want to Work With You. It's worth taking a look at. Jeff Young, No Bullshit Therapy. But you put your finger on something very important. There's been a lot of controversy about preparing people or not. Walk in or drop in. There's a little political correctness discussion going on. Maybe we shouldn't call them walk-in because some people have mobility challenges and they can't walk in. And some people click in now, or they drop in. So we're oftentimes using the term open access. But some people said just it's an all-comers meet. And when they show up, do whatever you do with them. And other people said, yeah, but it would be good to get a little background information. It helps the therapist to be oriented. It also helps the client to be oriented. So, what are they going to do for me? What am I hoping for today? Of all these problems, what do I want to focus on right now? So that the person has a realistic idea. So yeah, that's, of course, it's probably better if the person is motivated, psychologically minded, has a simple problem. But many cases that we've seen, and there's millions of cases, at least hundreds of thousands of cases around the world now. There's books in Japanese, Swedish, German, Dutch, as well as many books in English, and in Italian, of course, too. People are coming in. Sometimes people have really serious problems. We might say, oh, that sounds consistent with the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. But they don't want to fix borderlineism. They want to figure out what's a way not to be so upset, or how can I have a friend that doesn't get angry at me? Somebody else may come in who has schizophrenia, as call it, or the hearing voices, but they want some particular help with the problem. So we have to work within the person's system. At the same time, if we see something that's very worrisome, of course, you say, we can talk about this, but the kind of things you're talking about, some people might want to focus on some of those other issues. Is that something you're interested in? If not, we don't have to. So it's a fine line of being inviting, but not making the person feel that unless they deal with what we think is most important, then they haven't had therapy or it won't be helpful to them. So that's one of the difficulties we've had.
And as you said, you can use your preferred model or theoretical orientation. It is more of an overlay of structure how to work. After listening to you, I would imagine a therapist would have to be very aware of the time, because I have 50 minutes and I have to very quickly join, tap into a goal, make that goal manageable for the time, operationalize it, connect to the client's strengths, and turn it into some takeaway. So this is a model that requires some skill as far as clock management, tying everything together. But I will tell you, and listen to this, I run, much like this mantra we've been using today, every session as a first and last session, I have two very different ways of working. I'm consulting, I'm working with therapists in training. In my private practice, I'm charging a good deal of money at this point in my career. Then I will have a sliding scale where other people can come. But if I'm charging a good deal of money, if I take the whole session going over paperwork or long diagnostic inventories or questions, that is not going to sell what the work would look like with me. So I want people, just my orientation, as people on the show know, I'm a common factors guy and draw from many things, but I want people to have a sense of what the work would look like, be able to connect to strength and health, and to turn some goal into some operationalized form of action. So while I would never consider myself a single session therapist, I think the best sessions are where clients can do these things that you've talked about. Highlight a goal, tap into their own strengths, and have some takeaway and action item between sessions. So I think you're preaching to the choir to a lot of successful therapists, even if they have never subscribed to this single session moniker.
And even if the client comes back week after week or every couple of weeks, each session can be a sort of a freestanding. You can say, oh, how'd that go since the last time? How did you use it? How did you apply it? Sometimes you'll meet with somebody and they'll say, I'd like to come back next week. We may want to say, why don't you give it a couple of weeks? And how are you going to use what we talked about? Where does the rubber meet the road? How are you going to apply this? What's the take-home message? How does this fit in terms of the reason you came here to see me? What are your next steps? So we're trying to get them to do something, not just talk about it, but do something. But yeah, so I don't think it has to be one session, but it's the idea of single session thinking that each session, I want them to walk out having had an experience and some ideas of how to use the experience, not just that, oh, that was interesting, or oh, that's something to think about. Let me give a couple of just very quick examples. The very first case in our single session therapy project was a long time ago. A woman came in and she had a very intrusive father. The parents had been divorced when she was a little girl, and the father was in and out of jails, and he was a bad guy in many ways, and she didn't want to have him calling her and demanding things and being difficult. We're talking, and she said, I just got to find a way to shut the door in his face and not have him bother me. I said, that's a good idea. Let's practice that. She said, huh? So I got up, and we walked to the door, and we practiced her opening the door, imagining the father was there, and how she would draw a line, set a boundary. I don't want to talk to you anymore. Leave me alone. Go away if I want. We sat down and she talked about how difficult it was, but then we talked about what would happen if she did not do this. Oh, he's going to bother me more. He's going to threaten my children, etc. So she found motivation and she found the skills to be able to say no to him. There was another case. It was another role-playing kind of case where a woman came in who also had a problem with her father, and she announced that she wanted to have an emotional divorce. I said, how would that work, an emotional divorce? She wanted the therapist to function like a minister in reverse, a divorce minister. The ring is broken, the paths separate. And I said, oh, how would that look? And she had planned it out, and she had printed decree of divorce, and we did a divorce ceremony in the office, essentially. We did more than that. But that was a couple of examples. Sometimes it's helpful to use internal allies. A gentleman came in who had a strong grief reaction He was an elderly gentleman, and his wife had gone and had open heart surgery, and she had died in the surgery, unfortunately, tragedy. She had thrown a clot and died in the recovery room. He came in feeling bereft and sad, but also feeling guilty because he had really promoted her having the surgery. As we talked, and I said to him, I don't mean to be presumptuous, sir, and I don't know if you have any religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs, but if Ethel was in heaven and could look down and see how you, what would she advise you? And he said, she'd tell me to snap out of it. And I said, why would you say that? She wanted to have the surgery to make me happy so we could do more things I like to do. Then said, what would be a good way to honor Ethel? Would it be good every day to say, I'm going to do some positive thing and I dedicate this? So it gave a different meaning. He could do positive things as a way of showing his caring for his wife instead of just grieving about her. I saw a woman in my office. We were not getting anywhere, and she had a problem with a boyfriend. And I said, who's your superhero? She looked at me and said, you're a superhero. She said, oh, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I said, what would Buffy do? And she said, oh, Buffy would kick his ass. And I said, I don't want you to be violent, but could you do something in the spirit of Buffy? She laughed. She said, oh, I can Buffy. And she began to talk about how she could use her Buffy-ness to deal with the situation better. Let me mention just very quickly, another model that's been very helpful is at the Bouverie Center in Melbourne at La Trobe University. They've developed what they call single-session family consultation. Someone who's having ongoing multiple session, ongoing individual therapy may say, it'd be good to have my family come in for one meeting so we could talk about certain issues. So it's a single session consultation within that structure of an ongoing therapy.
It is a mindset. And as I said, you need a certain amount of preparation and skill. But if you go into this, you may run into some errors. So what do you think are the most common errors?
The most common errors. I think the most common error is number one, trying to do too much, talking too fast, trying to cover six things in 50 minutes. Here's a reading list. Here's all these other things you should do. Here's a website you've got to read. I think it's better to do one thing well rather than jump around four or five things. Then the client doesn't feel like they really got much. It would just buzz by them. So I think that's one thing, trying to do too much. A second is feeling that I have to do my theory. I always do CBT. I always do structural family therapy. I always do EMDR. I always make dynamic interpretations. What is the client's theory of therapy? What do you think would be helpful? What have you tried in the past? How did that work? Finding out what they want to do, because oftentimes they are the experts in their life. And there's a lot of evidence. I'm a common factors guy too. There's a lot of evidence. It's client factors that make the big change much more than therapist techniques.
We always say on this show that the client has, or the system has, enough issues. Trying to conform to my way of working shouldn't be another one for them. We should be flexible to match their worldview and what is going to work for them. So I do think that's part of the skill in attuning to that very early on in your session.
I think a lot of what we call resistance is they are not worshiping our psychotherapy God. Like, they're not in our religion, our theory, our model. And so we've got to convert them to thinking the way we do. And until they join our club, they're resistant rather than just what you're saying. We have to find a way to see things through their eyes. So one prior common error is trying to do too much. Another is insisting on your theory. Another is saying to people, you're only going to get one shot. We do single session therapy. If you don't hit it, you're out of here. Right? Assuming that the complete resolution of whatever problems are the only way to resolve things. Maybe there's other ways to deal with it. Wanted to say something, if I could, about cross-cultural context. One of the errors I think a lot of times we make is we approach things through our lens, our view. It's always dangerous to talk about cross-cultural because there's all the stereotypes. When you talk about the Chinese or the Jews or the Americans or the Italians or gay people or whatever group. So you have to be careful you don't just fall into stereotypes. But with that sort of proviso, my colleague, Terry Su, who was born in Hong Kong and moved to the U.S. when he was very young, wrote a really good paper about his doing a single session therapy with a Vietnamese American woman. She had seen another culturally unattuned therapist previously Well, she was having some problems with her father, and the therapist, that other therapist, kept trying to get her to differentiate, individuate, separate from your father. Don't take care of him. Take care of yourself. And from her collectivist viewpoint, that wasn't going to work. She needed to find a way that she felt that filial piety. She was respecting and honoring and helping her father as well as herself. So they had to find a situation what felt to her like a whim. So somebody who's in a collectivist mindset, taking a more individualistic approach may not be useful. Let me give you just a couple of very quick examples from my experience. There was a Filipino couple we called. Again, so you say Filipino. Are they Filipino-American? Are they from the Philippines? Are they professionals from the big city? Are they farmers from out in the island somewhere? So there's all these socioeconomic cultural issues. But this couple called and the wife said, I would like to come in and talk to somebody. I don't feel my husband loves me the way he used to. And I said, oh, okay. Yeah. And he spends time with his brother and he goes to visit his mother, but he's not as close to me as he was. I said, oh, okay. So they came in and from my reading, or I should say misreading of Mnuchin's structural family therapy, I had the idea we needed to detach him from his family of origin and get him more attached to his family of election. Stop going to visit mom and your brothers, spend more time with your wife. And it went nowhere. But they were very polite, so they made another appointment to come back. I realized I was missing something, so I went and I talked to one of my colleagues, who's Filipino, and I said to him, tell me, what am I missing here? And I told him the story. He said, you suggested that the husband should not go visit his mother or not help his brothers? I said, yeah, he said. And he looked at me like, you really did that? Well, yeah, he said, did you ever ask the lady what would make her feel more loved or when she used to feel more loved, what was going on differently? No. So they came back and I said, oh, I think I was a little premature. And what used to happen that doesn't happen? Oh, he would call and leave a nice little voicemail on my message at work. Oh, and I'd come out and I'd find a little note on my windshield from him with a little heart drawn. There was no mention about dumping mom or brothers or anything. So I think we need to work within the system. What makes sense to them? In another situation, I was seeing a Mexican-American family, and they had a boy, I think it was 12, Octavio, and they were just having conflicts, and both parents came in, a Mexican-American Latino family, and there came a certain point, and I said, Octavio, I think you need to show more respect to your father. And he nodded, and I said, look your father in the eye and tell him what you're going to do. And Octavio got very nervous and looked at the floor, and the session just ended. Nothing much happened. And a lady called and said, Doctor, I don't think we're going to come back. Octavio says he doesn't want to come back. It made him very nervous at the end when he was on the lick. In our culture, you don't stare your father in the eye. And she didn't say this, but I put him in a double bind because if he stares his father in the eye, he's going to get in trouble with his father. And if he doesn't, then he's disrespecting El Doctor Hoyt. He's not doing what the doctor said. If you can't win, you don't want to play. So he decided not to come back. It would have been much better. And later when I was doing some teaching in Mexico, I'm not quite bilingual, but I can fake it sometime. But we came a time with another family. And I said, do you think it would be good to a young man to show more respect to your father? And he said, yes. And I said, how could you do that? Rather than me telling him from my Anglo-American view how he should do, I said, how could you do that? And he explained some of the things. I looked at father and I said, sir, would that be good for you? And he said, yeah, yes, it would. So again, it was working within the person's cultural system rather than applying our system that may not be quite the same.
These are great examples, Michael. Oh, yeah. I wish we had another hour, but as we run down the clock, let me ask you, I think another development that has made this such more an attractive option certainly in a post-COVID world where people are expanding to telehealth and there are more options of providers available, a single session as far as trying out therapy and seeing what that's like becomes more attractive than ever, I think. What developments do you expect in the future of single session therapy? Let's say we have this conversation down the line and 5 or 10 years from now, what are things you expect in the future?
More single sessions, it's getting more acceptance. Therapists are liking it. Clients are liking it. I think particularly we're going to see more walk-ins, drop-ins, click-ins. Lots of different clinics have in Canada and Australia and my colleagues down in Texas. It's a lot more about walk-ins, open access, come on in when you're ready, no appointment needed. So we're going to see more of that. We're seeing it being much more global. As I mentioned, there's books in many different languages all over the world. So it's getting much more global. A third area I think we're going to see a lot more development is the family and child area, couples and family therapy. There's a program in Australia now, WIT, Walk In Together, and it's a systemic family clinic that they can either literally come in person or virtually on the computer. So we're going to see a lot more of that. There's also another really interesting development going on, single-session interventions, which are similar to single-session therapy, but they are digital. They're on the computer. And a woman named Jessica Schlater, who's a professor at Northwestern in Chicago, and there are many studies. Young people in particular, where do they spend a lot of their time online? And also people who don't have a lot of money for whatever reason or certain stigma want to be able to access some kind of mental health service. So there's single session interventions where there's not a therapist present, but there's programs they can work through. A lot of them have to do with behavioral activation. So I think it's going to be very interesting. There's going to be the traditional kind of therapies that we're doing, more briefer therapy. There's also a general movement in our society, do it yourself, make your own plane reservations, look it up on YouTube, all of that sort of thing. And I think that fits with the ethos of people when they're stuck needing a little help to get unstuck, but then they can do more on their own. At the same time, I think there will be plenty of work for whoever wants longer therapies. So again, single session therapy is the idea of one session at a time, and the person can come back if they need, but if the person doesn't come back, they should at least have left with the idea that they got something useful. Every client who comes in, we think of ourselves as therapists, as agents of change. Sometimes people don't want to make big changes. They just want some support. They want to unburden themselves, get it off their chest. They want to check something out. So I think it's important to ask the person, what's your goal? Jay Haley used to say to clients, I saw him do it. Jay would say, if I told you we were only going to meet once, what would you want to talk about today? In that case, I'd really want to talk about what I need to do. And he said, why don't we start there? That way they would get what was most pressing and most important to them. So I wanted to finish, if I could, with a question for listeners. It's a little, you'll see where I'm going with this. Here's my question, listener. Suppose tonight, while you're sleeping, a miracle occurs. That when you wake up tomorrow in your office, you're an even more effective, efficient therapist than you were before. In fact, you're doing more one-session, single-session therapy, and clients are benefiting. What will you be doing differently when you're doing more single-session therapies? What techniques will you be using? Where will you get the information? How will you know that it's being helpful? Obviously, it's from the miracle question and DeShazer and Berg and all of those folks. But suppose tonight, while you're sleeping, a miracle happens and you start to do more single session or deliberately one session therapies. What would be some of the things you'll be doing to make those more effective? I hope this has been helpful to listeners. I would be delighted if somebody has a particular question that I can easily answer.
Michael, they can email you at drmhoyt@comcast.com. That's Dr. M. Hoyt at comcast.com.
I'd be glad to answer it. So if something comes up and I can be of help in an easy way, and I really appreciate your interest, Eli. I look forward to reading your book that's sitting here on my desk in front of me, Bringing Common Factors to Life and Couple and Family
Therapy.
It's
very nice of you, my friend. You could have interviewed yourself here, but I will say that your book, which you have shared with me and I have read, much apropos to our theme, in the equivalent of a session in the last hour, you have distilled quite a bit of information in a way that I believe will give listeners a good idea to the book, Single Session Therapy, A Clinical Introduction to Principles and Practices from Routledge. You can get it directly from Routledge or wherever you find your favorite book. Michael Hoyt, delightful to speak with you. And I look forward to following the evolution of single session therapy. You gave us a lot to think about. Thank you so much. Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy, from Routledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Stay systemic, my friend.
It's after the Eli of AAMFT show. The latest insights to love. Couple family therapy. Help them feel you.
Stay systemic, my friend. To be like,
hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we illuminate. From theory to practice, there's so much to know. Join us on this journey.